to see us tearing along the barbed-wire-wrapped coast. Dymchurch, Hythe, Folkestone, Ramsgate, having these little chats with policemen and Old Salt along the way and getting nowhere fast. Finding out absolutely nothing while my son could be dead somewhere. I just told that man a terrible lie, Pris. I told him you weren't being yourself, but really I should have said you are being exactly yourself. The first fisherman had just returned from Dunkirk, having saved heaven knows how many lives, and that constable is going to look out for Tim. We will find him, but we won't find him in an instant. I should have let you do this alone, but I could not sit still, just could not sit still a minute longer. She folded her arms. Then let's get on our way. They were silent along the route, stopping in Dymchurch and then Hythe. Never mind water and a bottle of ginger beer each. Why didn't I think of bringing a flask of something to soothe my nerves? That was a huge error on my part, said Priscilla, lighting up another cigarette, then extinguishing the lighted end with her thumb and finger and throwing it out of the open window. I should probably slow down with these things. Luckily I've got a stash, but they'll go on ration, and... Oh, dear, I wonder what he wants. Maisie looked into the rearview mirror, at the police motor car gaining on her, bell ringing. The driver had opened his window and was waving at Maisie to pull over. I'm not surprised your foot turned into lead as we left Hythe, said Priscilla. Maisie manoeuvred the motor car to the side of the road. Both women once again took out their identity cards. The police vehicle stopped in front of them, and the policeman in the passenger seat left the motor car and walked toward Maisie. "As a rough guess, I would say you're about to go to Holloway Prison," said Priscilla. "Oh, Pris, give it the elbow," said Maisie. She opened the door and stepped out, ready to meet the policeman at her full height. "Miss Dobbs," said the policeman as he approached. He bent down to look at Priscilla through the open window.
"And Mrs. Partridge?"
"Yes," Maisie and Priscilla responded at once.
"Not many motors on the road, and certainly not one like this. We had an urgent telephone call from our colleagues along in Sussex, and we thought we should intercept you. You're looking for a vessel named a Cassandra?" "Shortly after you left Rye, a fishing boat came in, and the skipper raised the alarm that another boat had found her drifting without power and is towing her back to Rye. It's a distance and slow going from the channel, but she should be home before dark, and of course there's the tide to consider."
Priscilla had already leaped out of the Alvis to join Maisie.
"My son! Is my son all right? Timothy Partridge? Is Timothy Partridge on the boat?"
"I understand there are two boys and some soldiers. There are some wounded, but both are on board."
Priscilla ran back around the motor car to take her seat once again.
"Come on, Maisie! Hurry up! Hurry!"
The policeman addressed Maisie.
"Best if you follow me, miss. Best all around."
"Yes, thank you, Sergeant,"
said Maisie. She placed a hand on his arm and felt her eyes fill with tears.
"Really? I can't thank you enough."
"All part of the job. Much prefer being the bearer of good news. And it's not me to thank, but Constable Shearing down at Rye. He's the one who put out the call. Now then, before your friend becomes a casualty, let's be on our way. You follow. I'm the one with the bell."
Two ambulances were standing by at Rye Harbour, and members of the local women's voluntary service, with their distinctive green uniforms, had set up a table with sandwiches and flasks of tea. Another woman was folding a pile of blankets. As soon as Maisie had parked the motor car, Priscilla ran across the road toward Constable Shearing. He held out a hand as if to steady her. In the meantime, Maisie stopped to speak to the Coast Guard.
"According to Mick Tate, over there in the fishing boat, he saw the Cassandra being towed back toward Rye by the Mistress Molly, another of the fishing boats. They'd found her out there, making her way back from France, but she had almost run out of fuel. She had been attacked by them bloody Germans."
He looked up at Priscilla.
"She one of the mums?"
Maisie nodded. "Yes, her son is a very good friend of the owner's son. They sail together a lot."
"I heard. Those lads took out the Cassandra without anyone knowing. went off and joined the flotilla of boats going to Dunkirk to help bring our boys off the mole. They are bloody little fools. But you've got to hand it to them, haven't you? He paused, but before Maisie could reply, he continued, Young Gordon's mother is in Ramsgate, and as soon as we've found her, we'll get her here. She's looking out for her husband as well as her son.
Poor woman, to have that worry.
The coast guard nodded toward Priscilla again. She had begun walking along the embankment as if to follow the River Rother out to sea, her hand to her forehead, looking toward the point where the estuary met the sea, though it was far in the distance and not visible.
You're going to have to keep an eye on your friend. Mick said they'd had a good number of soldiers on board, but some went on to the other boat, towing them. One of the boys was down, so the other lad was working himself silly to keep her going, and he's been injured himself quite badly.
What do you mean, one of the boys is down? Asked Maisie.
The Coast Guard shook his head and half turned away.
I mean he's gone. He's dead.
Maisie brought her hands to her mouth. She had become light-headed, yet her feet felt as if they were indeed made of lead, as if it would take every ounce of her resolve to move.
You all right, madam? Said the Coast Guard.
Tim is my godson. Oh, heavens, this is terrible. I must go to Priscilla to stand with her.
Perhaps I shouldn't have said anything, said the Coast Guard.
No, no, you did the right thing. I'm prepared now. I've got to be Priscilla's strength, and I must telephone her husband to get him down here. I know where to contact him. I can get him here soon.
The Coast Guard directed her from the harbour to a telephone kiosk. Maisie ran along the road, rummaging in her pockets for change. As the door closed, the odour from every human being who had ever stood in the kiosk seemed to be leaching up from the floor and enveloping her. Struggling for breath, she opened the door, keeping it ajar with her foot, as she asked the operator to connect her call.
Chelstone, mama?
The butler answered the call.
Simmons! Simmons! Is Lord Julian at home?
Yes, indeed, your ladyship. Just one moment, please. Hold the line.
1 minute. 2 minutes. Maisie made a small, cylindrical pile with her coins on top of the telephone box, ready for use if the pips sounded. She adjusted the pile, counting the coins once more. Then a click on the line.
Hello, Maisie. How are you?
Lord Julian, thank you. Yes, I'm all right. Well, no, not quite. You are the only one I can trust to keep calm. Douglas Partridge should have just arrived at the Dower House with Tarkin. I would like George to collect him and bring him to Rye Harbour as soon as possible, but not with Tarkin. You must find a means of drawing Douglas away from his son to tell him the reason.
She recounted the news she had been given by the Coast Guard.
Right you are. It will be done exactly as you've asked. Leave it with me, Maisie. I will also let your father know what's happened. I am sure Mr. Dobbs will find an enjoyable means of distracting the boy.
There was a second of silence and the pips sounded. With shaking hands, Maisie pushed more coins in the slot, cursing when a coin dropped to the floor.
Lord Julian, are you still there?
She asked.
Yes. Still here.
She heard a catch in his voice.
I imagine George could get him there in about 40 minutes at a fair clip, and, Maisie, do keep us informed.
Yes, of course. I must go now.
She replaced the receiver and stepped out into the fresh air. Priscilla had walked back and was standing on the harbour wall, binoculars to her eyes. Constable Shearing gently placed his hand to one side of her, not touching her clothing but close. Maisie saw Priscilla nod and move back to a safer point from which to keep her vigil.
"See anything yet?"
said Maisie as she approached her friend.
"You can't see anything much from here, but when I walked alongside the river I saw a little speck in the distance. But it's difficult. The marshes can give you an optical illusion, so what you think is a boat is probably a farmer crossing his field with a horse and plough."
She tapped the binoculars.
"The Coast Guard kindly loaned these to me."
At that point the Coast Guard called out,
"I can see them. They're coming in."
Priscilla drew the binoculars up to her eyes again,
Where? I can't see them. Where are they?
Let me look, Press. Priscilla passed the binoculars to Maisie and stepped closer to the water again. And again the policeman drew her back.
You don't want your son to see you in the drink when he brings that boat in, do you?
Maisie trained the binoculars into the distance. At first, she could see nothing, not even a farmer with his team of horses drawing the plough. Then a speck appeared, glistening mirror-like in the mid-afternoon sunshine. Yet instead of anticipation, she felt dread, for until the boat docked, until the lines had been drawn in and the vessel tethered, the wheel of fate would continue spinning. Only when those on board were home would it stop, and for one mother, the terror would not end. The dot in the distance continued to grow in size as time passed. Two fishing boats cast off in the direction of the Cassandra and her saviour, the Mistress Molly. Soon, another motor car was parked alongside the Alvis, and as Maisie looked up, she could see the effort with which Douglas Partridge wielded his cane as he limped toward his wife.
"Oh, darling, you're here!"
Priscilla rushed to her husband's side. He allowed his cane to drop and pulled her to him.
"Tim's coming home! Tim's coming home, and he's almost here!"
I know, my love, he's almost here."
Maisie knelt to retrieve the cane.
"Thank you, Maisie," said Douglas. "And thank you for sorting everything out, for getting me here."
"You spoke to Lord Julian?"
asked Maisie.
"Yes. He brought me up to date. I know what's happening."
"What's happening is that our son is almost home, Douglas."
She took his arm and began leading him toward the harbour wall.
"I promise I will not admonish him in front of everyone for this escapade. I may have to fling my arms around him, though."
Maisie and Douglas exchanged glances.
"Don't embarrass the boy, whatever you do, Priscilla."
He pointed his cane toward a cluster of people waiting alongside the women with their tea and sandwiches.
"There's a newspaper reporter and photographer over there, and I'm sure Tim would not want to be on the front page with his mother clinging to him. Whether you like it or not, our son is a hero."
Priscilla shook her head.
"I never wanted heroes."
It was late in the afternoon when at last the Cassandra drew into full view, behind the fishing boat towing her in. The two vessels seemed to stop their progress as another fishing boat joined them. People around began muttering, speculating about what might be happening. Douglas grabbed Priscilla's arm to stop her running in the direction of the boats. Then a fisherman pushed back his cap and smiled.
"Good on him, good on him."
"What is it? What's going on?"
Priscilla called out.
"I know what he's doing," said the policeman. "He's giving the Cassandra enough fuel to get to the harbour. He's letting her come in under her own steam."
And as the crowd became silent, the rumble and fail of an engine trying to start echoed along the river, until after a chug, 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 the engine fired and began running. A cheer went up, and the boats began moving again toward the harbour. Priscilla screamed out her son's name. People clustered together to watch the launch pull into dock. The young man at the helm calling out instructions to soldiers on board, who threw out lines from the bow and stern to waiting fishermen. The soldiers' faces were stained and drawn, their exhaustion evident in the way they half stumbled toward hands waiting to receive them. Maisie could see the skipper, his face black with oil, his shirt red with blood, and bandages wrapped around his left shoulder and arm. A fisherman from one of the boats was standing behind him as if to support the boy should he fall. The coast guard clambered on board to reach him, turning off the engine, then joining the fisherman to help the young man remain upright.
"I can't see who that is," said Priscilla. "He's hurt. I hope it's not Tim. I hope he's not been wounded."
Maisie looked at Douglas, who rested his hand on his wife's shoulder.
"You should wait here."
He walked toward the Cassandra, just as two ambulance men made their way on board with a stretcher.
"Maisie, what is it? What's happening?"
As Priscilla struggled to speak, It was as if she were learning every word anew. Maisie held on to Priscilla's arm. There are wounded on board, Priscilla. The man at the helm will not leave until everyone has left the boat. Even if he's falling down with exhaustion, he will not leave. He may be young, but he is the captain. And in that moment, she felt a glimmer of hope. Priscilla watched as the ambulance men began to leave the boat. And with movements that showed a deep respect, and Maisie thought, gentleness, they brought a blanket-draped body ashore. The crowd moved aside for them to continue on. Oh, my God! Priscilla turned to Maisie. Is that Tim? Is that my son, Maisie? We mustn't think like that. Let's wait and see. She felt her voice crack as she again drew her attention toward the Cassandra. The two ambulance men approached the boat once more, this time without a stretcher. They made their way on board, then stopped and stood aside. Instead, Douglas was helped onto the boat by a fisherman. Maisie squinted, watching Douglas approach the Coast Guard and the young man who had brought the Cassandra home, and as Douglas allowed his cane to fall a second time, to pull the young man toward him, she felt Priscilla begin to give way. Don't fall, Priscilla! Don't fall! He's home! Tim's home! The Coast Guard handed Douglas his cane and guided him off the vessel. He turned back to watch as Tim began to walk toward the stern. Priscilla ran toward the Cassandra, with Maisie following. Reaching the vessel, she opened her arms to her son. Yet as she witnessed the reunion, Maisie saw the blood running down Tim's arm, his hand limp as his mother relinquished her grasp. Priscilla, hold on to him, he's going down! And as Maisie knelt alongside Tim, she pulled back the dressing on his arm and saw the extent of his wounds.
He was it, miss, said one of the soldiers. The same one that got his mate. They came out of the sky right at us. Them two couldn't get down in time because they were trying to get us home. Pair of bloody heroes, them boys. I don't know how that one got off so far, but he kept saying he had to get Gordon home. That it was his job.
Chapter 16. As soon as Tim had been placed on a stretcher and lifted on board the ambulance, Maisie gave instructions for him to be taken to the Royal East Sussex Hospital in Hastings. Then she ran to the telephone kiosk once again. George, the Compton's chauffeur, pulled out to follow the ambulance, and as the two vehicles drew onto the main road, a cheer went up from the soldiers for the two boys who had fought to bring them home to England. Once again, Maisie piled her coins onto the telephone kiosk and began to dial a number she knew by heart.
Andrew Dean?
The greeting was short, with no reference to the number called.
Andrew, I am so glad you're home.
Maisie, hello. And I'm only just home. I almost remained in London. Had soldiers with some terrible wounds being brought in. We've been operating around the clock since the evacuation began.
Maisie had once walked out with Andrew Dean, but friendship had replaced courtship, with cards exchanged at Christmas and Easter, and birthdays remembered. Andrew was now married with two children and had risen to become not only a renowned orthopaedic surgeon, but also a professor of orthopaedic medicine in London.
Andrew, I know you're exhausted, but this is terribly urgent. It's Tim, Priscilla's son.
She explained what had happened and gave Dean her assessment of Tim's wounds.
Right. Consider me on the way. I'll telephone the hospital now and have a theatre prepared and Tim made ready as soon as he's brought in. I know the best vascular man to assist, and I'll get him over there. I'll be at the hospital by the time you arrive, Maisie.
In the hospital waiting room, Maisie, Priscilla, and Douglas spoke little, each immersed in their own thoughts. As she sat and stood and paced, Maisie remembered Billy and his prescient words.
That's the worst thing about being in a war. It's not the fighting, or the tunnelling, or any of the bleeming terrible jobs you have to do. No, it's the waiting.
Soon enough,
though, the door opened and Andrew Dean beckoned them into a private office. Once they were seated, he ran his hand through hair slicked back with perspiration.
First of all, I have no idea how Tim managed to garner enough strength to bring a boat back from France. His resolve was a miracle in itself, as is the fact that he is alive.
But how is he, Andrew, and when can we see our son?
Priscilla's hands were balled into fists.
Douglas reached out to cover one hand with his own. Go on, Andrew. Please tell us how Tim is faring.
I will tell you now that, having examined him when I arrived, I took Tim into that theatre not knowing if I would be able to bring him out alive. The operation was a long one. You know, you've been waiting, but he endured the anaesthetic and the procedure.
He cleared his throat.
The fact is that the humerus bone in the left arm was shattered. He had sustained vascular damage and various connective tissue was all but lost. I am afraid devastation to the limb, together with a huge risk of spreading infection, meant that the arm could not be saved. I had to amputate it just here.
With his finger, he drew a line across his arm just below the shoulder. Maisie heard both Priscilla and Douglas gasp. Andrew Dean sighed.
I'm so very sorry. If I could have saved the arm, I would have. In the meantime, infection remains a great risk. But I have used something very new, a purified type of fungus known as Penicillium, though it's now known as Penicillin.
Fungus? You've put a fungus into my son?
Said Priscilla.
It's terribly new, as I said. Well, it's new for use in the medical field, and I was fortunate to have been asked to contribute to research regarding its application in hospitals as a tool to use against possible sepsis. It's not available to most doctors yet, but I have great faith in it, and in my work so far it seems to far exceed the results we've had with the usual sulfur-based compounds.
When my arm was amputated, it was in France at a casualty clearing station, said Douglas. I remember that terrible smell of sulphur.
But better than gangrene, said Maisie.
And I'll never forget that smell, added Priscilla. It was the odour of death in the back of my ambulance.
If there is a saving grace, it is this, said Dean, looking at Douglas. Tim has a strong family, and a father who knows exactly how he is going to feel. He will require all your support and guidance as he emerges from this trauma.
He paused, drawing his attention to Maisie, then to Tim's parents.
What Tim witnessed during the evacuation will remain with him forever. It's something we cannot imagine, and those memories cannot be taken away. This is all more in Maisie's line of work than mine, but he will have many mountains to climb, especially the weight of survival because his friend was killed. He will regain dexterity, as you know, Douglas, the other arm becomes stronger, but he will be forever changed.
Dean stood up, his shoulders rounded with fatigue.
I am a surgeon, and when operating I have to be dispassionate, seeing the body as a machine. It is my task to give the machine every chance of working properly again, though the cogs might look a little different. But I also know the difficulties involved in true recovery, and it can take a long time. Tim has an advantage I cannot prescribe. His spirit.
When can we see him?
Asked Douglas.
Not before tomorrow. My suggestion is that you all go home to Chelstone and get a very good night's sleep if you can. Tim will prevail. The fact that he came home, that he kept his wits about him when the pain would have felled a lesser man, is testament to his ability to endure.
The sun was shining as George drove Priscilla and Douglas back to Hastings the following day, along with Tarkin, who had been told about his brother's journey to Dunkirk and what happened when he came home. Having waved them off, Maisie brought the Alvis around to the Comptons' garage, where she parked it and left the keys on George's workbench. She patted the bonnet and closed the door behind her. It was not a great loss, the lack of a motor car to hand, though it might prove to be inconvenient, She hoped the day ahead would be a quiet one. Perhaps she would read to Anna, prepare Sunday lunch, and visit her in-laws, who were anxious for news of Tim. Brenda was waving to her as she reached the path that led from the garage up to the Dower House.
"Telephone for you, Maisie," she called out. "It's your Mr. Beale. Says it's important."
Maisie ran to the house and picked up the telephone receiver. "Billy, how are you?"
"All right, miss. What about Tim? Did you find him?"
"Yes, we did. He's home." Maisie recounted the story of Tim's arrival back in Rye and the news of his operation. There was silence on the line.
"Billy?" "Yes, miss. Just thinking about Tim and his mom and dad. I know this sounds a bit off, but I half envy them."
Maisie nodded. "I think I know what you're going to say, Billy."
"I thought you would. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing, but the boy has been to war now, so he'll never be blaming himself for not going. And he did something not a lot of lads his age would have done. So he's lost his arm. But the fact of the matter is that now no one can send him anywhere to lose his life, can they? He can get on with it and make something of himself like his father's done."
"Yes. Yes, I believe you're right." Maisie paused. "But you called for another reason, Billy. What did you find out?"
"I think you had an inkling of this, or you wouldn't have been so specific with what you wanted me to look into. It's Teddy Wickham."
"Go on," said Maisie.
"His mum, maiden name was Doris Robertson. And there's more.
Sally Coombs."
"Right, first time. She's Jimmy and Doris Robertson's sister."
"And probably met her husband through Jimmy Robertson, because Phil Coombs was in the army with him."
"What's that you always say in that line? Didn't you say Walter Scott wrote it? Oh, what a tangled web we weave.
When we first practice to deceive."
"But why did..."
"Not yet, Billy. Having dodgy relatives doesn't make people criminals. We've a little way to go. As I said, they can stew in their juices. I think I understand this particular web, but I need more evidence."
"All right, miss. See you tomorrow."
"I'll be back in the office late morning. I'll tell you what I think we need to do then. We've time." Maisie replaced the telephone receiver in thought for a moment, her hand remaining ready to make another call. She picked up the receiver and dialed.
"Chelstone Manor."
"Hello, Simmons. Is Lord Julian in his study?"
"I have just taken him his morning coffee. Her ladyship has departed for a walk with the dog to cross to the stables. Shall I tell him you'd like to speak to him?"
"I'm going to come over to the house now, Simmons. Please let him know I'm on my way."
"Right, you are. And may I say how glad we all were to hear that young Timothy Partridge is on home turf? It might have been better news, but at least he is home."
"Yes, he's home. That's the most important thing. I'll see you in a few minutes." When Maisie entered the Manor House library, Lord Julian was standing behind his desk, looking out at the grounds. He turned as the door opened and came toward her, his hands outstretched.
"Maisie, my dear, what a trial seeing your dear friends go through such a terrible time, waiting for news of their son, and now this. We have come to enjoy their company. If there's anything we can do..."
"Thank you so much," said Maisie. "I think, though, it's going to be a time of waiting and helping Tim through the coming weeks and months of recovery. I believe he will be spending a good deal of time here at Chelstone, along with his family."
"Full house, eh? We're at capacity here, too, what with the Canadian officers. Good group, though. We've grown to enjoy having them here. The supper conversation has been very lively."
He motioned to Maisie to take the chair on the opposite side of his desk.
"Coffee?"
"I'll pour," said Maisie. She topped up Lord Julian's cup and served herself a half cup of the thick black coffee from the silver pot bearing the Compton family crest, a coat of arms also engraved on the matching tray, milk jug, and sugar bowl.
"What can I do for you, Maisie?"
He took his seat.
It's about the Bank of England. Do you think you could find out if there have been any attempts to mount a robbery? I'm thinking of the transportation, bringing notes of currency from Hampshire into London.
I can find out.
And I know I've asked this before, but I assume every precaution is taken to reduce the risk of such an attempt.
I have been informed that it is so.
He took a sip of coffee, then replaced the cup in the saucer, returning it to the silver tray.
What do you know, Maisie?
I am not sure. It's pure speculation, really. But I would advise extra precautions for the next week or so. I think the risk of a criminal act has passed, but one cannot be too sure.
Have you alerted the police?
The police need evidence, Lord Julian, and I don't have any at the moment. All I have is a series of observations. But the real crime I'm concerned about is not one of theft, but of fraud, and I believe it has to do with the War Office. Lord Julian raised his eyebrows and leaned forward.
Go on.
How does a business land a government contract in a time of war?
Pretty much the same procedure as when the country is not at war, though with a few degrees more secrecy. Companies are invited to tender their estimates for work or supplies and also provide references to support their work. The government does not necessarily award a contract based upon price, but other aspects of the supplier's credentials are taken into account, delivery record being of prime importance.
I see. And how does a business become known to a government department? Previous work? References from another source?
Both of those might be the case. And, of course, sometimes the principals in the business receive word that there is a contract to be awarded, and they request to bid along with everyone else.
I suppose no one would admit if there were some degree of...
Would that American word, graft, do? Is that what you're looking for?
Lord Julian sighed.
Interesting that here the same word means hard work.
He shook his head.
I can't say corruption doesn't happen, and in a time of war especially it could be seen as a treasonable act, given that it undermines the integrity and therefore strength of the government. It diminishes us all.
Lord Julian held Maisie's gaze.
You would tell me if you had knowledge of such an act.
It's down to evidence again, Lord Julian, and making the connections between people I've met. I don't want to point a finger at the innocent. Maisie looked out of the window behind Lord Julian. Oh, here's Rowan now.
Don't dare leave before seeing her. This business with Tim, you see. We've become very fond of the boy, and when we heard what had happened, it brought back such memories of... Well, you know.
Yes, I do. There's always something to remind us of James, isn't there? As Maisie turned to leave, she noticed a uniform laid out on one of the leather armchairs. Lord Julian, the uniform, is it yours?
Afraid so. Our newly formed local defense volunteers unit, and I seem to have been volunteered in my absence to be the figurehead of the Chelstone Brigade. Seriously, though, with the threat of invasion and with our proximity to airfields and being between London and the coast, it's a case of every man being called upon to bear arms to protect the country. And as the prime landowner in this area, I have a responsibility to do what I can. We've a good number of men in the village and beyond who fought in the last war, and of course, some who cannot fight in this one. So it's time we all stepped forward to do our bit.
He smiled, shaking his head.
Rowan thinks it's terribly funny, seeing as I was last in uniform a good few decades ago, and rarely even lift my gun to go after a pheasant now. Though with this rationing business I might sharpen my eye on bagging a few. Anyway, they've already started calling us the Home Guard, which I think sounds more like a shield you put in front of the fire to stop sparks catching the carpet.
Maisie laughed.
I am sure you're the very best leader they could hope to find anywhere. A catch, indeed. Lord Julian placed his hand on Maisie's shoulder as they walked to the door.
Let's hope we can catch the odd German parachute landing in a field, eh? That'll show them what we're made of.
He took a deep breath, and a wave of gravity seemed to envelop him.
Maisie, I know I can tell you this in confidence, but it's important for us to consider the possibility that we may all have to move, and in a hurry. The fall of France does not augur well for us, and the Prime Minister is ordering authorities in Kent and Sussex to prepare for complete evacuation in the case of imminent invasion. It obviously hasn't come to that yet, though children are already being evacuated from certain coastal areas. But we must be prepared.
With Anna now almost fully recovered, Maisie relented and agreed it would be perfectly all right for Frankie to take her down to the stables to groom Lady, her pony, though she cautioned against tiring the child.
"We'll have no backsliding," added Maisie, smiling as she waved to her father as he led Anna by the hand along the path toward the stables.
Brenda put the kettle on the stove and sat down at the kitchen table, patting the place opposite.
"You've not told me yet what Mr. Klein wanted to see you about," said Brenda.
Maisie rubbed her forehead, her mind still lingering on the conversation with Lord Julian.
"Just a few minor points."
"Minor?" said Brenda.
Maisie avoided Brenda's gaze.
"They prefer to approve adoptions where married couples are concerned, not widows or spinsters, and definitely not bachelors."
"But you are already her guardian.
Her grandmother signed the papers."
"Guardian in a limited capacity. There was no time for Mr. Klein to prepare the documents required for full guardianship, so my standing is a sort of temporary guardian with a responsibility to place Anna in a good home."
"This is a good home," said Brenda. "The very best for Anna."
"Don't worry. All is far from lost, Brenda," said Maisie. "The new stricter adoption laws on the books for ratification were cancelled when war broke out, so there are avenues remaining to me. And a local billeting officer has commented in her report that it might be difficult to place Anna elsewhere anyway, given her parentage, which really means her colouring. Then the problem of her father came up, Maltese Marco, who came and went out of Anna's mother's life before she was even born. So as I said, there are avenues. I have great faith in Mr. Klein. I just have to be patient."
"So, the war that brought us Anna could be the war that helps keep her with us."
Maisie nodded. "I really do hope so, Brenda, but I'm almost scared to imagine it." Brenda reached for Maisie's hand and held it tight.
"It'll all come right, love. I believe it will all come right."
"By every canon of military science, the BEF has been doomed for the last 4 or 5 days. Completely outnumbered, outgunned, outplanned, all but surrounded, it had seemed certain to be cut off from its last channel of escape. Yet for several hours this morning we saw ship after ship come into harbour and discharge thousands of British soldiers safe and sound on British soil."
Maisie had read enough, so she folded the copy of the Manchester Guardian and placed it where she had found it, on the seat next to her, discarded by a previous passenger. The train began to slow, signalling that the last stop, Charing Cross, was only a few minutes away. She opened the Daily Herald, this one left by a woman who had been sitting opposite her until departing the carriage at Waterloo. She glanced at the front page headlines and turned the page, where a smaller lead caught her eye.
"Boy, 16, young hero of Dunkirk. Timothy Partridge, 16, of Holland Park, London, took to the high seas last week in a motorboat belonging to his best friend's father. Tragically..."
She rolled up the newspaper and slid it into her bag. She could not bring herself to read another word, but would clip the column later in case Tim wanted to keep it. But perhaps not yet. That morning, she had left the Dower House before breakfast, agreeing with Brenda that it would be best not to disturb Priscilla and Douglas. The pressures of the past week had weighed heavily on the family, and they were all becoming more and more anxious about Tom, who had not been heard from for some days. At the office, Maisie went straight to her desk, where she removed her coat and gloves and placed her briefcase and shoulder bag on the table. Yet again, she had left her gas mask hanging on a hook behind the door when she last departed the office, and upon seeing it, made a promise to take it with her today. She would also make more of an effort to keep the gas mask at hand at all times. Maisie took out her notebook and began reading through notes she had made on Sunday afternoon, devising her plan for the coming several days, when she would, she hoped, track down the evidence to support her belief that Joe Coombs's death was no accident. A noise outside distracted her, so she stepped across to the window, where she saw Walter Miles on a stepladder, weaving fresh clematis shoots up across new trellising. It appeared the plant had sprouted up a few inches almost overnight, and was reaching toward the gutter downspout. She watched for some moments as the man worked in the colour-filled courtyard. "And why don't my clematis bloom like that?" she whispered to herself.
"Miss, something you should know,"
Billy called out to her as he entered the office, throwing down his newspaper and wiping his brow with a handkerchief.
"And what's that, Billy?"
she replied, frowning as she drew away from the window.
"Been talking to Phil. He was outside when I came past the pub, smoking enough to put a chimney to shame he was. I asked him what was troubling him, and he said it was his Archie. You should see Phil. He's got a temper on him when he likes, and right now he's like a madman."
"What did Archie do?" asked Maisie.
"He's thrown in his job at the engineering firm in Sydenham,
and he came round this morning to tell his mum and dad he's enlisted and is going in the army. He's not even waiting for his call-up papers to arrive."
Maisie grabbed her bag and jacket. "Just when I need the Elvis, she's in the garage at Chelstone." She did not stop as she ran toward the door. "Come on, Billy." As they reached Tottenham Court Road, a taxicab screeched to a halt as soon as Maisie raised her hand, and they clambered into the back of the vehicle.
"Faraday House, please," said Maisie.
"Faraday House? What are we going there for?"
"Just a guess, but I think Archie has planned the imparting of his news down to the last minute. Vivian will leave the building for lunch in about 15 minutes, and I would bet that Archie is waiting there for her."
"Why? I mean, I know she's his sister, but..."
"I believe she's also an informant for Jimmy Robertson. Consider this. The Coombs family are a good family, and you can tell that Phil and Sally have done their best to bring their children up to know right from wrong. But just because you know right from wrong, it doesn't mean you stay away from the wrong part. The family is still connected to the Robertsons. They've grown up in the shadow of Uncle Jimmy. I would say they've kept it quiet, but a man like Robertson keeps his hooks in."
"Blimey," said Billy.
"I can't explain now," said Maisie, as the taxicab drew up alongside Faraday House. "But what would you do if your uncle was Jimmy Robertson, and you've reason to be scared of him? Perhaps because you're in deeper than you thought you would ever be."
"Believe me, Nick, I'd run away."
"That's what Archie is doing, and the war is giving him a good opportunity to make his bid for freedom from those hooks." The taxicab began to slow down as they reached their destination. Billy leapt out as it came to a halt alongside the curb and held the door open for Maisie. She paid the driver and looked up and down the street. "Now we wait. But not for long. If Vivian comes out to go for a sandwich and a cuppa, and Archie isn't here to say goodbye to his sister, then we've missed him. It means I've guessed wrong." They stood for a few minutes, Maisie fixing her attention in one direction, while Billy kept his eyes on the other.
I think that's him, miss. See? Coming toward us, along the pavement.
Maisie cast her gaze in the direction indicated by Billy. Yes, that's him. Let's go toward him. If he meets Vivian, there will be strength of denial in numbers, and I want him on his own.
Right you are, miss.
Maisie and Billy walked toward Archie Coombs, who seemed dressed for a cooler day in a dark suit, a black overcoat, and with a dark grey fedora on his head. He was smoking a cigarette, cupping the lighted end in his hand.
Hello, Archie. How about that? What a coincidence bumping into you. How are you?
Maisie smiled.
Hello, Miss Jobs. What are you doing here?
Actually, Archie, I am so glad to see you. I've been meaning to have a chat. Can you spare a moment? I know where there's a calf quite close by.
I can't, miss. I'm meeting my sister and she's due out of work any minute and she don't get long for her break.
Oh, not to worry. Mr. Beale will wait for her.
Goodest done, miss, said Billy.
Meet you at that place you told me about, where you went with Vivian before?
Maisie nodded.
Yes. When I've had my chat with Archie, we'll join you. Come on, Archie.
But, Miss Dobbs...
Archie, I want to talk to you about Joe, and about your cousin, Teddy Wickham.
You can't all enlist to get away from your Uncle Jimmy. The next thing we know, Vivian will be in the ATS, or even the Wrens. I hear all the girls enlisting want to get into the Wrens for the uniform.
And your Viv is a stylish young woman. She laid her hand upon his arm.
Help me, Archie. This is about your brother, not the supplies or the Bank of England, though I think I know why that might interest you. Come on, Archie. Take the brave way out. You can't run forever.
You don't know what he's like. He'll kill us. I told Joe. I told him keep your mouth shut about those bloody headaches. I got him some aspirin powders and told him to just knock a couple back every day and he'd be all right.
Tears welled in Archie Coombs's eyes and his hands were shaking. Rivulets of perspiration beaded his forehead and began to stream along his temples down to his jawline. I will do everything I can to protect you, but help me, Archie. Help me for Joe's sake. Help me for your brother. Archie Coombs looked from side to side, then back to Maisie.
I'm so scared, Miss Dobbs. I never thought I could be so scared. I thought it can't be any worse, being in the army, being shot at, than looking over my shoulder at every motor car, wondering if my number's up.
He began to weep. Come on, Archie. Let's go over the road. Let's find a place to sit down and have a chat. Chapter 17 Some 15 minutes later, Maisie and Archie reached the cafe where Billy was waiting with Vivian Coombs. Billy stood up as Maisie approached. They exchanged an almost imperceptible nod, and Billy smiled at Archie and his sister.
I'm leaving you two to talk to Miss Dobbs now. Lovely to see you again, Viv, and thank you for asking after my Billy. Can I get anyone another cuppa before I go?
I think we're all right, Billy, said Maisie, taking a seat and pulling out the chair next to her for Archie to be seated as Billy left the cafe.
Vivian, Archie has been talking to me about the difficulties involved in being related to Jimmy Robertson, and I wonder if I can ask you a few questions? I just want to connect the dots, if I may.
Uncle Jimmy's not a difficulty, Miss Dobbs. People thinking he is, that's the difficulty. He's been good to us.
She turned to face her brother.
And you should learn to keep your mouth shut, you stupid idiot.
But Viv...
Maisie held up a hand. A row between the two of you isn't going to help matters, and neither is denial, Vivian. You could be in a lot of trouble and lose a very good job. I just want to get some things sorted out. And you probably don't know this, Vivian, but Archie was on his way to barracks and was coming here to say goodbye to you when I bumped into him. He's enlisted, so you don't have a lot of time with your brother.
Oh, that's just wonderful.
Vivian glared at her brother.
You yellow-bellied twit.
off to join the army because you can't get anything right. See what good that did Teddy. You're like a child with his hands over his eyes who thinks no one can see him.
Oh, leave off, Viv. Things are bad enough as it is.
Archie rested his head in his hands, elbows on the table.
And don't loll around on that table. I know people in here. You'll have everyone looking at you and you'll show me up,
added his sister. All right, Vivian, here's your choice, said Maisie. You either talk to me now, or you'll be talking to the police for hours on end. You're going to have to talk to them anyway, but you can make it easy on yourself by starting to tell the truth right now. Get into practice. You're in trouble, but it might not be as bad as you expect, if you cooperate.
I've been cooperating since I was a child. I'm fed up with cooperating with someone. Mum and Dad, and now Uncle Jimmy. I suppose you want to know all about Teddy too, don't you?
Actually, no. I know about Teddy, and I know all about Archie. What I want to know about is every step that was taken so your uncle was awarded the contract to supply Mike Yates with a special paint to use as a fire retardant on airfields.
That? You want to know about that? That was nothing much.
Vivian Coombs smirked and turned away, her back to her brother and her right shoulder to Maisie. She lifted up her handbag, which she had placed on the floor, and took out a lipstick and compact. She proceeded to apply the red lipstick, rolling her lips together before closing the compact with a snap. Maisie could see she struggled to control her shaking hands.
And how long do you think I can stay here in this cafe? I've got to get back to work.
Maisie looked at her watch. Not long now.
Just another couple of minutes, then you can go. But first, that contract, how did you find out about it?
Vivian Coombs sighed and flapped her hand at Maisie, as if the answer were hardly worth her time.
I'm on the government exchanges, you know that, and I heard it on the line. It's not as if they're all scrambled after all, and not all the calls are important or top secret. Most of the time it's just one boring civil servant speaking to another boring civil servant. Anyway, it was before the war when I'd just been promoted. I heard this bloke talking to another bloke about putting the contract out to tender, that it had to be done quickly. None of this waiting for months. Painting the airfield buildings with that special paint to stop fires was urgent, on account of the expected attacks and the chance of invasion if war were declared. I knew Uncle Jimmy was always looking for a new bit of business, and that he'd sold paint to Yates before, so I let him know. After that, I didn't do anything. He's got his ways of finding out about the other bids, so he made sure he got it. I can't go about my job listening to everything.
Just as well, Maisie sighed. But you were rewarded for your trouble, weren't you?
I don't know what you mean, said Vivian.
Come on, Viv, she knows, said Archie. And this is about our Joe. Uncle Jimmy wasn't on the up and up, not with that paint.
Maisie watched as Vivian Coombs looked at her brother, then at her hands, and when she met Maisie's eyes, her lips trembled. You're a strong young woman, Vivian, and you are loyal to your family. Your uncle has seen you all supplied with some lovely things in the past, gifts that made life a little easier. You've had brand new clothes, good shoes, nice furniture, all sorts of little extras. And he had that telephone put in at the pub. It wasn't the brewery, was it? She looked from Vivian to Archie. Your family were the recipients of stolen goods, and have been for a long time. Being a receiver of such items is a crime in itself, but the passing on of confidential information carries a different kind of punishment in a time of war.
We weren't at war, not when I told him, said Vivian. I just thought I would let him know.
All in your favour, Vivian, that there was a limit to your sharing of information from a confidential government call, but the judge might see it as simply a question of semantics, said Maisie.
Of what?
Asked Archie, Vivian rolled her eyes.
She means it's down to how the judge sees it, that big bits of information are the same as small bits when it comes to language. It's confidential whether it comes from the Prime Minister or the cleaner when it's on a government line, you dopey item.
It's the seriousness of the crime that counts and character, said Maisie. Fortunately, you weren't in on the most egregious part of the crime.
What was that? Said Vivian.
Archie began to weep, his head low, his shoulders revealing his grief and fear.
Oh, you bleeming watery head, I wish you'd pull yourself together,
said Vivian to her brother. She took her bag and began to stand up. Archie looked up at his sister.
You're not as hard as you try to be, Viv. Uncle Jimmy killed Joe. He might have got him that job so he was in a reserved occupation, but he was killing him slowly because he was adding other stuff to the paint to make it go a lot further. He wasn't supplying Yates with this stuff exactly as it was shown to him by the RAF bods and the government officials. I know. I'm a slave in his bleeming engineering works. I know what he does. And he was doing things on the cheap, so we made more money, a lot more money. He was thinning it down so he could sell it to other businesses for painting factories, shops and all sorts of other buildings, telling the landlords that it would save their properties from burning down when the invasion came and we were bombed. He couldn't use water because it would have just gone lumpy like rotten eggs. So he used chemicals. Mike Yates was in on it. And yes, Dad wanted me and Joe to have jobs where we wouldn't be called up. But what were we really protected from, eh? No one protected Joe, did they? That stuff was killing him.
Maisie watched the siblings argue back and forth, then saw her chance to interject. Joe was made very ill by the paint. Possibly he was more susceptible to the toxins due to his age and the fact that he was still growing. And because he was the apprentice, he was set to work on tasks that demanded most exposure to the poisonous vapor. Decanting the paint into the smaller pails, stirring it to mix the chemicals, and then the final testing, setting the blowtorches on the finished walls where he was breathing in even more danger. There are more pathology reports to come through, but ultimately Joe was not killed by the paint or an accident. He was murdered, and his life was taken because people knew about his health and that he was suffering. He had to be stopped, because the more he talked about his headaches, and the more he wanted to leave an apprenticeship that was considered an otherwise good opportunity, the more attention was drawn to him, and therefore to the job he was doing and the materials he was using. If he continued complaining, it was only a matter of time before the paint was subject to renewed testing by the authorities. Your Uncle Jimmy needed time, time for the contract to run its course, enabling him to make as much money as possible. And the contract could go on for a long while, given the number of new aerodromes being built and any repainting required after the job was finished. Vivian stared at Maisie, her mouth open.
You want to watch that, love? Something might fall in if you keep it that wide.
Caldwell stood over Vivian Coombs, then pulled up a chair and sat down. Maisie shook her head and sighed.
This is Detective Chief Inspector Caldwell, with the Golden Tongue from Scotland Yard. He would like to speak to you both on his premises and not here in the cafe. A motor car is waiting outside, so my advice is to accompany him without attracting attention.
She turned to Caldwell.
Thank you, Inspector.
Vivian Coombs came to her feet.
But I have to get back to work. You don't understand. I have a shift.
All sorted out, love. Your supervisor knows you've been a witness to a serious crime, and that you are providing us with invaluable information for which you could well receive an important reward. Your life.
He drew his attention to Maisie.
Now then, Miss Dobbs,
Would you be so kind as to lead the way, and I'll bring up the rear, as the saying goes.
Outside the cafe, Caldwell shepherded the siblings into a police vehicle and turned to Maisie.
They'll be at each other's throats all the way to the yard, mark my words.
He held out his hand to Maisie.